the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Lisa Scottolini is the New York Times bestselling author of 16 novels and 2 books of essays. She writes a weekly column called Chick Wit for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has won many honors and awards, notably the Edgar Award given for excellence in crime fiction. She also teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she received a BA in English and a law degree. Francesca Scottolini Saratella, Lisa's daughter, contributes columns of her own to the Chick Wit series and essays in their most recent collection, My Nest Isn't Empty, It Just Has More Closet Space. Lisa graduated from Harvard University, where she received the Charles Edmund Horman Prize and the Baron Russell Briggs Prize for her creative writing. She has also won the Thomas Temple Hoops Prize for her senior thesis, a novella. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Lisa and Francesca.
Hi, thank you for having us. This is really fun.
Great, well, I'm glad you're here. And that's a very long introduction with a number of prizes.
Oh, you're very kind.
Just so we know, too, she's the one that went to Harvard.
Right.
I'm not that smart.
Well, you went to...
I'm a nice person, but I'm not as smart.
You went to University of Pennsylvania Law School.
Yeah, it ain't bad. It ain't bad, but...
But it's not Harvard.
I can't claim the Harvard part.
That's too bad. So do you make fun of her in print
a
lot? I didn't read that in here. That you're making fun of her.
No, it wasn't any disrespect to University of Pennsylvania. I just had to get away from home.
How dare you? Yeah.
Well, fortunately, you didn't disrespect Pennsylvania. You disrespected your mom's.
Which is a great American tradition, too.
Right, great. All right, so anyway, a family of overachievers. You graduated magna cum laude. Right? In 3 years? You graduated.
I did.
And your concentration was contemporary American fiction, taught by Philip Roth and others.
Yes.
Crazy. But then you went to the University of Pennsylvania Law School.
Right.
Tell me, I mean, as an author looking back, what made you do that?
Well, I think, you know, I went originally because of Perry Mason. I know. You impressed yet? I wanted to be Perry Mason.
I didn't know he was there.
Sadly. Okay. And I just always thought it was really interesting and dramatic. Mm-hmm. But it really, and I loved being a lawyer. I was a trial lawyer. But when she was born, and I sort of got divorced at the same time, let's not recommend that to the viewers.
Okay.
I really thought that I wanted to change my life to stay home and raise her. And that's when I thought, you know, you always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. You can't get any more broke than you are now. You might as well start.
Okay, good. So that's the pathway you're recommending is go out and
divorce and failure.
Okay. Well, I think I can get half of that. is there another academic degree in your future after having just graduated? Are you thinking, I read on one place you said you were... in rebellion against your mom, you thought about going into veterinarian school,
yes,
right?
When I was in high school, I was so sure, you know, I'm not going to be a writer, I'm going to be a vet. And I love animals and was okay at science, so it seemed possible until I realized just how icky blood is. I have to dissect them.
Wait a minute, you're the daughter of somebody who's won for crime novels. And you find blood icky.
A little bit.
I'm light on the autopsy stuff. I leave that to people like Patricia Cornwell.
Okay.
Read about it, but to actually be tearing them apart, that's quite a difference.
So. Okay.
Smart
so girl. You won't commit murder, either of you. If you do, it's going to be through poison or something
like that. Right, right.
Okay.
Well, I think my books anyway, you know, as you know, as a writer and someone who's looking a lot at novels, I don't really think in terms of genre anyway.
Okay.
So they say they're crime novels. I don't think they are. I think they're stories about women who lead interesting lives and get themselves in trouble, have to get themselves out again. So I actually steer clear of all the goopy stuff. I'm not into it.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the writing that you do together or you work for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you trade back and forth sometimes writing this column.
We do.
You're writing from the viewpoint of the mom. You're writing from the viewpoint of the daughter, now living in a different city, and tormenting your mom by, at least in one of the essays in here, one of the essays you wrote, going out and not telling your mom where you'd gone, which is just cruel.
Oh,
see,
it tell
is.
Me about that.
Thank you.
You're already coloring it in a way that it wasn't true. It wasn't that I didn't tell her. In fact, we had an entire conversation about, you know, street smarts and safety. I was going on a date with a very nice gentleman, a lawyer that I had met.
Wait, think she'd gentleman, be understanding, lawyer,
right?
Same thing?
How
oh,
dare
sorry,
you?
Go ahead.
How dare you?
Yeah.
She's just preaching to the choir. So I told her all about, we talked about, you know, meet him at the restaurant. Don't, you know, go back home alone. Don't let him know where you live. What I didn't do was call and check in with her at multiple points during the date. Mm. Yeah. And that apparently was cruel.
Back
I just didn't realize.
Right,
yeah. I just smack around. I
read something conservative estimate, 20 phone calls and 58 texts.
Within that's one hour. Representation.
And you forget now, she emailed my roommate, too.
Oh, she emailed your roommate.
Oh, why don't
right.
And
this
the
was
knife
all before
in.
Even 2 in the morning. It wasn't like I was out.
Yeah, but this is all in the book already, so I'm not releasing any information.
It's on the record.
It's on the record that yeah, you
true.
Did this to
I
your mom.
I plead guilty.
Okay.
Well, it's sort of funny, because when you think about how these books evolved, the column started when I went to the Inquirer and said, mm-hmm. listen, well, actually, what I said was I miss Irma Bombeck. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was a lot of, obviously it's tough times, but the newspapers are always full of bad news anyway. I thought we need something funny in this news. We need, because mm-hmm. I think back to Russell Breaker, or think of the more political columnists, Roy Coe. I grew up reading those guys, and Irma Bombeck was one. I said, can I do that? Will you let me do this? And I wrote so much about my family life, which includes her, that people said, you know, why don't you let her tell her side of the story and shut up for a change? And that's actually what happened. That sort of evolved into the books.
Okay. So how often do you get to tell yours? And most of these are your essays in this most recent book.
Right.
But you have, it says, contributed some essays.
As far as the column goes, I usually contribute about once a month. Mm-hmm. And as we continue with these books, I might be able to contribute more, and I would love to. But mm-hmm. it's great. It's really nice to have a project that we can collaborate on. But she's kind enough to give me my own space to have my own voice, develop it. I get to write them, you know, in New York. So it's mm-hmm. nice we can work together, but not necessarily crowd each other.
And you describe it as edit each other's work.
No.
And you just, whatever goes in, goes into the column.
Right.
Have you worked on something where you did do that and it seemed to be difficult? Or you've just always said you have your own space?
We never have. I mean, I sort of, first off, I think she's enormously talented, and I really like to encourage, well, she's my daughter, and I really want her to develop her own voice. As a parent, I feel that way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's true, you know, people who are listening or watching now, I really do think that everyone has a book in them, and everyone has a voice that they need to find. So my approach to this whole thing has been, trust her, let her develop it herself. She sends it in, it's her byline, and they're great. Okay. I don't think...
So there isn't a time you've had a fight and she has a column due and you think, boy, I don't know. No, I'm kidding.
No, she never has to worry about me as far as deadlines. But I do. I mean, it was a conscious decision. Certainly, you know, high school, just growing up, she would help me. And of course, you have that normal parent-daughter friction. But mm-hmm. I think that's something... That's why I made that choice to not have her edit me, because I think you can always find a critic, and you only get one mom. And mm-hmm. I have a terrific one, and so I try to protect her in that role. I do, as a supportive cheerleader.
I'm really
going to
need some more friction here. You
know,
novelist, you know drama.
I know.
We have
drama everywhere else.
Okay.
I'm not.
We're girls. We had drama getting ready for this interview. We had to get ready, you know, I mean, like.
Well, you sort of coordinated. You came very close to OSU's colors.
With
scarlet and gray. This is blue, I think. I'm slightly colorblind. If I'm right, if we do the color corrections right.
Yeah, it's sort of slate or something.
Slate-ish. But you came well prepared.
We did actually think that on the way over. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
Guys.
So tell me about, you talk about helping her to develop her voice. I'm interested in the way that you created your voice within your fiction, how you worked through that to come to something like that.
I've done 17 novels now writing a memoir. You sort of see that there isn't really much of a difference. And it's funny how it sort of proceeds almost naturally from the discussion about her. And mm-hmm. maybe something that would help your viewers and listeners, because I really think that the key to developing your own voice is getting out of your own way. You know, so I kind of got out of her way. And my own process, I mean, you talk to lots of writers. Most of us, I think, are deeply insecure. At least the ones I like are insecure. The secure ones are full of themselves. But
the who are?
The real secure ones.
Oh, okay.
I never really liked a specific name.
There is, but
we can't say on that.
No, we can. Not my problem. Go ahead.
But I sort of like, I think the development of voice is so allied to the development of identity as an adult, and also changes over time. And part of it I find at home, when I'm writing and we're all alone, I'm just looking at that computer screen going, just keep the negative voices at bay, get out of your own way, and just write it down. My mantra, and I've told it to her and so she knows this is all true, is like, get it down, then get it good. Mm-hmm. And that's how I think you find your voice. You just get it down relentlessly, and I'm talking over years, and you start to let yourself emerge.
What does that look like for you in a day of writing? What does that look like for when you're getting it down? How do you go through your day? How do you get it down?
Well, this is where you find out how dull my life is, and I basically work all the time. I work a lot. Mm-hmm. So I started about 8 in the morning, and I have a big coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and I just try to get out of my own way and tell a story. I don't outline anything. I just start with the premise and go, and that's for a full...
So you write completely linearly, you're not...
Yeah. I mean, if I think there's a flashback, and I've done novels where there's been flashbacks, mm-hmm. We'll just put that in then. I don't plan anything out.
Okay.
Impressive, huh?
Oh, that's yeah.
it.
Somebody
that's cool in here that will say it. She outlines a little more than I do. I mean, you do a little more planning.
Yeah, I think the process is probably in very individual, but yeah, I do some sort of, I almost think of just meditations on the characters, the plots, or things I want to include in themes. I have a little note page to write that all out so that I don't put it so explicitly and heavy-handedly in the actual writing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I work with word count goals a day, and that helps me just to make sure that I get something down. Just like she's saying, you can judge yourself so harshly that you get a little bollocked up mm-hmm. and really don't get anything on the page. So the word count goals help me to just make a progress that at least I have something I can look at the end of the day and move on forward.
What's your standard word count?
I try to do 1,000 to 2,000 words a day, and so I ramp up. And when I'm starting, I feel less confident. There feels like there's decisions to be made on every paragraph. Mm-hmm. You know, what is this character like? I don't know yet. I don't know them. Mm-hmm. So and then I'm usually shorter, more close to 1,000. But when I'm in the thick of it and I feel like I know the characters and I can just sort of put them in something, a situation, and they do it themselves, sometimes I can get up to 2. She's awesome. She can do...
Well, I try to do 2,000 as well, and mm-hmm. I don't, I'm always nervous till I get a first draft down, because, you know, people say, do you know how it ends? I don't know how it middles. I don't know anything. I know. Great, huh?
Never heard that used as
don't
a verb
tell
before.
Me.
I don't know how it middles.
Well, right? We can make this stuff up. Mm-hmm.
You can make this up. You've got 17 novels. I can't make this stuff up. I mean.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, okay. So tell me, why do you enjoy, or you enjoy legal fiction? Tell me about the writers that you admire.
I mean, I mean, legal fiction, like, that's another thing. I don't like a lot of legal fiction.
How about the genre of women who get in trouble and need to get
out of
it?
I know, and I admit. Yeah. I mean, sometimes legal novels can be very boring. So I don't really like that. Mm-hmm. I read really widely. I like thrillers. And I also like memoir. I think Stephen King has a great quote about if you're, you know, anybody who presumes to write and doesn't read first is a fool. So I sort of mm-hmm. always say to myself, if I'm not writing something, I ought to be reading something good for me. It doesn't mean that it's boring, because I actually don't, I think that's bad fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of my view. I always divide whether any kind of writing into good and bad. If it's good, it works. If it doesn't work, it's bad.
What
is that
about,
the question?
What about for you?
That
well, that's sort of the question. I mean, it's getting. I'm going to come back to
it. Kind of sucked at that.
But what about for you? Who do you read, and what are you looking for? Your mom's talking about the divide between good and bad, which is, I'm thinking, subjective.
Yes.
But what defines that? I mean, who do you read? What defines that? How does that work for you?
Well, I mean, I also try to read very widely. I'm fascinated by families, so I also like memoir. I have a weird affection for addiction memoir, even though I've never been addicted to anything, mm-hmm. simply because I think it frequently you get to see the seeds of this person's inner demons in their childhood or in their families, and then it becomes so exaggerated by the dire stakes of any that addiction brings, unfortunately. But so I'm interested in that. As far as fiction, I read so many different genres, but mm-hmm. The type of writing I admire most and I aspire to is sort of probably skews towards the sparse type of prose that really can pack a punch quickly. I remember studying the short stories of Graham Greene, and I hadn't even really been such a disciple of his in the novels. When I read these short stories, they were so remarkable. Many of them are as short as 5 pages, some are longer, mm-hmm. but he does not, it just such packs a punch. There's so much emotion and so much control of the reader and that perspective in these very simple prose, simple storytelling, and that's really what I admire most and what I think I enjoy reading the most.
Okay. Does that spark for you?
Well, I'm thinking about what's the definition of good, because I heard
you're the one that used the term.
I know, and you know what I think is not a bad definition? And somebody said it the other day, and I thought it was a reader, because we're on book tour. And, you know, so that's what's cool about it also, because she said, the kind of book that it's always on my mind, you can't wait to get back to it. That's a book that's working. And we can talk, and I'm happy to, about the myriad of decisions that somebody's making about plot, character setting, voice.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things that work together seamlessly, and they should be seamless, to make somebody go, I don't know why I'm liking this book, but I can't wait to get back to my purse where the book is, and I hope the train's late, and I hope she's late, and I hope everything's late so I can just sit and read.
Okay. I hope she doesn't call.
Yeah.
I hope
people
I sit home
get in the
wondering.
Way. I know.
Yeah, what's going on? Okay, so you write in your essays about being 50 years old.
55.
Okay. And
full disclosure.
I was just going to say 50. And the decade's lesson of asking for what you want. Okay?
Right.
And I quote.
Yes.
At 6:15 in the morning, a handsome young man arrived at my hotel room and blow-dried my hair. Honest to God, it was all I wanted from him, and that's what being 50 is all about. So tell me about, you know, you.
Why did you pick the most? Why did you pick all the heartfelt, moving?
Well, it's not a heartfelt, serioso. Moving show. We're in for the lightweight. No, that is interesting because, you know, it, in a joking way, is bringing
right.
up a lot of serious things.
Right.
Actually. So
he gets me. I might be in love with you.
I get that so often. You're the first author. But the question I have on something like that is, there's a lot of stuff in here that, I mean, you talk about finding a gray chin hair.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that are, you know, I'm not looking. How do you, where do you draw the line?
Right.
What is the line for you? And I'm not asking you to dish on things that are over the line, but there are times you think, oh, do I really
no
want
line.
To write about this?
No line. I mean, okay. I think you're right, because, I mean, it's funny. That's its point. But I always have that great Francis Ford Coppola quote, and he said something like, nothing in my movies ever happened, but all of it is true. And anybody who writes fiction, and anybody who writes nonfiction, we're all trying to write something true. Now, unless I bust myself, unless I, if I talk about getting a gray hair in my head, you've read that before. You've mm-hmm. heard that before. You go, who cares? And the point about these essays is that they're funny, and I think they're universal, and they're true. So I have to really tell something that's going to make me cringe and going to make, but that's the stuff that mm-hmm. what, we'll get the email about, or we'll see people at signings go, God, I remember the day I found a hair on my chin and it was gray. And you want to shoot yourself twice. And that's a true thing.
You as the author want to shoot yourself
twice? Yeah, totally you do.
Why twice?
Because it's so horrible that it's not bad enough you're growing hair, but that it's gray.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant because someone had written into you and that made
no.
you feel. Okay.
No. I feel great when people share my pain.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University. My guests are Lisa and Francesca Scottolini, mother and daughter co-authors of My Nest Isn't Empty, It Just Has More Closet Space, who were in town recently with the always excellent Thurber House author series. You can check out their upcoming authors at www.thurberhouse.org. While you're on the web, visit Writers Talk at www.writerstalk.org, where you can also ask questions of our upcoming guests or listen to or watch our past shows. Now, back to Lisa and Francesca Scottolini and Francesca's thoughts on her mother's influence on her writing.
So, but you're choosing not, at this point, to go that route. Presumably...
I just don't have any gray hairs on my chin.
Well, I was going to say that, but I didn't... What kind of influence do you feel that your mom has on sort of say your writing? And
I think that I have taken from her the importance of being vulnerable and forcing yourself to be vulnerable in your writing. So even though maybe I don't have the same gripes as my mother, I have written a column about, my grand gesture of love. I went, jumped two planes to visit an ex-boyfriend, and I was dumped. I was rejected. And I write about that because that happens. It doesn't, sometimes you make the big play and it doesn't work out. And that's okay, and I got such lovely, lovely email because that's happened to me, girl. You'll find somebody. It's so nice, the outpouring of support, but that's not why I did it. I do it because I think exactly what she said. You have to be real. You have to share of yourself. That's sort of the difference in fiction. You can share of yourself, but in this very veiled way where difficult things happen to your characters. You can put them through the ringer. For you, you have to mine yourself, what is that mm-hmm. source of honesty there?
And I've often wondered when people switch between fiction and nonfiction, you're talking about you've got to put your characters through that ringer.
Yeah.
There are times when, especially if you're writing women who get into trouble. Mm-hmm. You think, oh, geez, I don't want to do that to this character. But you end up doing it anyway. And well, how hard is that? You know,
you're I mean, not to get all woo-woo on you, but the character does it to herself. You know, so yeah, the point when I started to realize that when they say the character and plot are the same thing, like, I have to learn stuff myself, and I finally figured that out. Because if you don't know what's going to happen in the story, the character's going to do something, and that will, of necessity, advance the plot. And also, then people will start calling it character-driven in reviews, which they think is a really good thing, and I guess it is. But the truth is, the character did, and I go, it's just like your life. You know, we are what we do, and that is sometimes revealed in real time, you know. Mm-hmm. You find out, wow, my husband cheated, or wow, my wife took all the money out of the bank account. That's what she is. Now I know. And that does seem to a certain extent, happen serendipitously.
Okay. When you say serendipitously...
That's probably the wrong word.
I'm curious about
and
that
I because... I could barely pronounce it. It came right
it,
out.
It was beautiful the way you did it.
Thank you.
But... because what I was sitting here thinking is, as you're discussing that, I think, well, how often does it happen that you've got this and you realize that the characters are doing things that as the author, you think, oh, I'd like to do this, or I find this kind of thing fascinating. And then after you read it afterwards, you think, okay, I'm playing back something else. I'm playing some part of my life that is, it's transmuted in some way.
I think it's always a part of your life. You're always saying, because the question is always, what would I do? Because I think the key about my novels and about Nest as well is that they're very relatable. So it's never something that, while you might not do it, you can understand someone doing it. Mm-hmm. Most of the times I would do it. They're all my characters always some aspect of me, which doesn't, I hope that doesn't sound egotistical. It's just sort of like, it's just that I'm such an open book. I plumb myself to go, wow, who is this woman? Mm-hmm. And I think that's why people like her, because she's kind of like them. The whole point of Nest, the whole point of everything we write, is that it isn't about us. It's about women. Mm-hmm.
It makes me wonder about your arrest record, since you're writing a lot of women get into trouble, as you
I know,
say.
I don't always like when they break and enter, but sometimes a little B&E's, all girls got to do a little B&E's.
That's the quote for today. Tell me about your mom is a big part of, your mom, your grandmother, is right. a big part of your writing. Mother right. Mary, Mother Maria. Tell me about, she sometimes accompanies you on book tours. You've also said, I think she's 70 and says, you can be a prima donna at 70, I think is
she's
the quote.
She's 86
86,
now.
Sorry.
How do you know?
Oh, yeah. So what, you know, when she's accompanying you, and she also seems like she has a bit more of the critic side, because whereas you two don't critique each other, she has sent you critiques.
Right? Yes, well, she's big on... you know, grammatical ain't is not a word in her right. in her lexicon. So even I have ain't in a dialogue of somebody, mm-hmm. which as we know, you're trying to embellish character and mm-hmm. flesh it out and inform it. She'll say ain't isn't a word, and my daughter should not use ain't because she went to college. But it's great. But again, it's great right. because we get a lot of email about her, just how, because a lot of people, again, it's not about her. It's about their own mothers mm-hmm. and that generation. And it ends up being, in a funny way, I hope, you know, sort of, as you say, meditations on what are three generations of really feisty women about? Okay. And how are we like and how are we different? And okay. why?
All right. Speaking of three generations, one of the things you have in common is pets. You have one dog in New York, which is like 20 in Ohio. I think that's the exchange rate when you're living in New York. So you've got four, uh-huh. I think, cats.
And two cats.
And I think there are some
other.
There's
a pony and a horse.
Okay, a pony and a
chickens.
Horse.
And chickens.
Chickens, right.
The chickens were what I had been alerted to, that you were keeping chickens.
Awesome.
So what is this attraction, do you think, for the two of you and all the pets? And why isn't it more obvious in the fiction?
Well,
why aren't the chickens getting into trouble?
I know. Chicken in peril. It's a new genre. Well, for me, it started when I started to notice that people were getting multiple dogs and also multiple divorces. And I started to wonder, because everybody used to get like divorced once and now divorced twice, three times. And then people have three and four dogs. And I'm like, are these things related? Like, are mm-hmm. you trading in your husband for a dog? And actually, I think what's sort of happening a little bit is as women get older and get dateless, just speaking hypothetically, of course, not in my own case,
right, yeah, okay.
case incredibly social, right. that you find yourself buying love with fur, and my conclusion is there's nothing wrong with that.
Which is right. why you've got, I think, a book called My Next Husband Will Be a Dog,
yes,
isn't that?
Yes, there you go.
And there's a mug, probably, that goes along with that.
There should be.
I've seen this mug, actually.
It doesn't have to be divorced, though. It can be dogs are wonderful band-aids. You know, you've heard of band-aid babies. That's not a good thing to do in your relationship. But they're great when they're just a dog. When I went to college, she got a dog. She said she was going to name it after me.
Did that end up happening?
I had a place with three dogs.
Oh, okay.
I know.
That's the exchange rate. The exchange rate for children,
it's
three
nice
dogs.
Nice to know.
I have one dog and two children, so apparently I'm doing something wrong.
Just wait till they go to college.
And you're probably married to the same person.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Not even divorced.
We're not here to talk about me. We're not here to talk about me. You also received the Fun and Fearless Female Award from Cosmopolitan Magazine.
I know.
That was so fun.
So what's that about? How did this come about? How does an author get Fun and Fearless Award from Cosmopolitan?
Well, I think people, I'm going to avoid all the obvious because it's such a good straight line, but the truth is I think that they just like that I'm portraying independent women in the books.
Okay. Okay.
I cleaned that up nice, didn't
I? Yeah, you did, and it sort of left me hanging.
There. I know.
I was hoping there'd be more about something that happened at a author's retreat, a book signing.
No, they just found the books.
Okay.
She can't hold her cosmos.
Right.
Because the magazine keeps dropping. Is that it? That
can hold her.
Right.
Cosmopolitan magazine. You also teach a course at the University of Pennsylvania. Law school called Justice and Fiction. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the course content.
Well, I developed it. It was one of these things, again, where I go and I said, you guys need, because I think a lot, there's themes on my book about, well, if you want to say in crime fiction and mystery, I like the great themes. But go back to, you know, Crime and Punishment. Look at me.
Nice.
Yeah,
wow.
Right.
Nice.
That's nasty. That's me. We're like this.
Yeah.
Right and wrong, good and evil, justice and injustice. You know, murder is like, it's all-encompassing. And I started to more and more think about fiction. I mean, I've been writing for 20 years now, so it's practically, you know, Jurassic anyway. And I started to look at it, and I said, these law students should understand that fiction about justice grows in a social context. So it sort of grows out of the civil rights movement, To Kill a Mockingbird, post-Miranda, The Godfather. You know, there's a reason when everything turns topsy-turvy in the law, it turns topsy-turvy in fiction. And it's not a coincidence The Godfather is written after that upheaval in the criminal justice system. Because the crooks are the stars, right? We're all in love with Al Pacino for a reason. Because he's Italian. But that's the course.
Okay. All right. And you haven't taken this course yet, though.
No, but I have attended. I was sort of a mole, like I was a plant. Nobody knew I wasn't a real student. I went one day, and it was fun because I got to watch people, you know, on AOL Instant Messenger, like talking to their friends. And I was like, hey, this is my mom's course. Because she is such a nice professor. She lets them call her Professor Lisa. And
she lets them call her?
I'm not an adjunct, you know. Not the real deal.
And she, for this. How many people were in your class? 120 about in a lecture?
120.
She has no teaching assistants. She does it by herself. She would bring a little brown paper baggie with an apple and a Snickers bar for every single student. I packed them with her for every single student for every single class so that they would have something healthy and sweet during the lecture.
Okay, for when their fingers got tired.
Right.
The text in the middle of it, they could
really enjoyed the class.
Class was from 4 to 6:30, so they would be having dinner. There would be dinner time. I'm not going to sit in front of starving 120 kids.
They could go cannibal at any moment. They're lawyers, after all. Anyway, I want to thank you, Lisa and Francesca Scottolini, for being here today on Writer's Talk.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Great. I'm glad.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University with my guests, Lisa and Francesca Scottolini, mother and daughter co-authors of My Nest Isn't Empty, It Just Has More Closet Space. They were in town recently with the always excellent Thurber House Author Series, and you can check out the upcoming Thurber House guests at www.thurberhouse.org. And while you're on the web, you can visit Writer's Talk at www.writerstalk.org, where you can ask questions of our upcoming guests or watch or listen to our past shows. Join us next week for Gretchen Hirsch, book doctor and author of Back Again to Me. Here's a sneak peek.
A lot of my clients are wanting a back of the room book. A lot of them are speakers. And they want a book that they have at the back of the room.
That's a category. The back of the room book?
Back of the room book.
There's fiction, nonfiction, back of the room book. Okay.
And they want that so that when their speech is over, their talk, their appearance, that there's a book that people can buy. For some people, a major part of the income of speaking engagements.
Really? Mm-hmm. So how many books can you sell at a thing? What's your touchstone?
What happens generally at an appearance is you can almost count on 1 in 4 will buy. If you're lucky, it's 1 in 2. And I once had an experience of selling it out to every single person in the room. And it was a big room. So it was
Oh, that's awesome.
It was
now,
exciting.
Did you run into anything like you wouldn't let them leave until they bought
no.
a book? Is that part of the... Okay.
Until then, this is Doug Dangler from The Ohio State University saying, keep writing.